In 1831, a Frenchman named Alexis de Tocqueville came to visit America. His mission was to investigate this new budding government that appeared to allow for a flourishing of a society. After researching for many years, he wrote the book Democracy in America, and it was and continues to be one of the most influential books in world history. In that book, he has many insightful thoughts. I studied many of his writings in law school because he had a knack for discerning what was really going on and how our society filled in the gaps that used to be occupied by a monarchy. One of the things that was of most interest to France and the other Western governments was this concept of a separation between church and state. It was very interesting to them to understand how a government could function without leveraging the power of the institution of church. Now, obviously, there's differences of what this means, but our very first amendment to our Constitution states that Congress shall pass no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Wherever you land on the argument of what should and should not be allowed in the public sphere, what we can all agree on is our founders were very aware of the evils that come from the power of institutions in church. There was this almost universal desire in our nation to avoid these abuses of power that had ravaged Europe for centuries. So Tocqueville was very surprised when he came to America to see how the churches were flourishing in our societies. And he wrote this in his book. So religion, which among the Americans never directly takes part in the government of society, must be considered as the first of their political institutions. For if it does not give them the taste for liberty, it singularly facilitates their use of it. If you could paint a picture of his words, it would be that image of the picturesque American town in the 1800s, with a spattering of different buildings and homes, but at its center, a white steepled church. In other words, Alexis was describing that great American invention, the Community Service Church.
You're bright and shining like the sun. And we'll be shining till you come. I hear the footsteps coming, 2,000 years and running. These walls, Jericho, they come down. Oh, what a joyful sound. These walls, falling down. Why you love us, why you mind for us, higher than the angels.
Now, the Community Service Church is maybe the easiest, but in some ways also the hardest to describe. It is both easy and hard because it is the version of church that we are most familiar with. It's kind of like trying to describe water to a fish, right? It's in some ways easy to describe because it's that thing that they understand so well. It's also difficult to describe because they don't have a concept of air or land. So if you can imagine trying to describe the concept of oxygen in water to a fish, that's kind of how I sometimes feel about trying to describe the Community Service Church. In all of my interviews, when I asked for definitions of the church, I always got a very authentic and well-considered answer. However, in the course of those interviews, every person would say the words like, I went to church, or I am going to a church. And in that way, their use of the word was very easy to define. You might consider it as the local church. It is that geographical location, almost always with walls built around it, and it's the place where all the stuff happens. So, where the house church model was focused on a small, intimate gathering of Christians, and the institutional church had everything to do with a formal hierarchy, formal organizational structure, and a formal theology. The community service church is an expression of an informal influence in our society defined by the way that church serves its community. Now, it's easy to react to those three statements by saying, hey, my church is all three of those. And that's kind of my point. At your church, you probably have small groups, you probably have church leadership and a theology, and you are also probably serving the community in multiple ways. That's one of the most interesting things about this journey, is that historically, the best of the previous models are preserved and then incorporated into the new model. So I hope that kind of clears it up enough so that you can continue as I discuss the community service church. What I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time examining it in the 1800s, examining it in the 1980s, and then spending the majority of this episode discussing how our society has changed from the 1980s to now, and what does that mean for our community service churches. Taking Alexis de Tocqueville at his word, it was true. There was a time in the 1800s when the community service church was probably better defined as simply the community. There may have been only one or two denominations in a particular town, and only one or two particular churches in that town. The church building in the center of that community was the only place the community could actually interact with each other. And as such, it was the place that served the community. That church building would be the public school system, the public healthcare system. It was often the town hall. You'd even take votes for who would be mayor in that church. And then obviously it was the place where you'd get your spiritual or biblical education, hopefully from someone who'd been trained a little bit in the Bible, or at least with some wisdom and experience in leading a congregation or a community. And obviously it was the place for you to get your corporate worship. Corporate worship meaning a large group of believers getting together in person to worship their God. But if we move forward to the 1980s, which is when I was born and started to be raised in the church, a lot of things had changed in our society. There's this secularization that occurred in our communities, where the public school system, public health system, and others left the church and began to be governed by government services. Now, even though many hospitals are nonprofits, it's the rules of Medicare and Medicaid that often dictate how those hospitals are run. Speaking of town halls, let's forget it. Obviously, politics and government services were moved out of the church buildings into their own buildings. And while many would look at this to be a great failure of the church, I have a different perspective. I believe it's a great and wild success story of the community service church. I believe it's pretty fair to say in the Western world that no one hates the government or taxes more than Americans. And yet, the community service church convinced America to tax themselves in order for some people to obtain public education. Now, we will argue about what is taught in those public school systems, but almost everybody can agree to tax themselves so that some people who don't have access to education can receive it. The same goes for healthcare. There's a lot of arguments of what should and should not be provided, but generally, everyone is in agreement that there should be some form of healthcare available to those who can't afford it, which I see as this transition from the community service church doing things in an informal influence in the community, but convincing that community that we're going to shift this and we're actually going to make this a formal authority for us to do, and we're going to vote it in because we can all agree this is good and this is right. So by the 1980s, what I see is the community service church suffering a little bit as a victim of its own success. So that in the 1980s, there were primarily four different things that were being offered in the community service churches. First, it was still your sense of community. The only place you could talk to Bob about that problem you're having is at either Wednesday nights or Sunday services. Second, it became a place where you could provide a spiritual education for children. We kind of see this explosion of children's church because it is a valuable resource given the secularization of public education for parents to make sure that their children receive an interesting and entertaining education in spiritual and biblical matters. Third, it was still the place that was most influential to you in your own personal spiritual or biblical education. The things that are said or taught in your Sunday school classes or on Sunday mornings was the way that you would consume information to help you continue on your own personal journey in Christianity. Fourth and final, it was still the place of corporate worship. Now, if you heard that list and think, Caleb, there's actually way more that these churches did, you're right. There is. What I am trying to express is the most primary influences that churches had in individual lives and in their communities. For example, churches still did some education, but typically that was always private education, so you had to pay for it. Churches were no longer providing free public education. For healthcare, churches would still provide certain services for healthcare for their communities. Absolutely. However, communities experienced a primary influence of healthcare through the hospital systems. There were food drives that churches would do, which is right. However, food stamps came around, and so the primary influence of feeding those who can't afford food came from the government sector and no longer from individual or local churches. So, compared to the 1800s, churches had dramatically lost influence in their communities and in the individual lives of those who attended. But I think a good summation is these four aspects still play the primary roles or influences in individuals and in communities. Which brings us now to the heart of this episode. How have things changed in our communities and in our society and in our individual lives since the 1980s? The changes from the 80s till now, I think, best addresses what we are now experiencing in our community service churches. There is this friction between this mythology of the community service church that we have inherited from the 1800s and this understanding of what the church's role is in our lives and our communities as we grew up in the 1980s and 1990s. And the reality of where we are today. So let's start with the most obvious and the most transformative issue from the 80s till today, the new influence of technology in our personal and communal lives. Here's my friend Corey White, a futurist and technology expert, discussing the changes in education.
When it comes to technology and education generally, education is one space that is ripe for digital disruption. And digital disruption is what we call when digital tools enter a market, an industry, an area, and they disrupt everything. You think about the taxi space with Uber, completely upends that taxi model. That's what we call digital disruption. Netflix and Blockbuster, there's many, many examples. Digital disruption is ripe in education. We have taught our kids exactly the same way for centuries, millennia. We sit them down in front of a teacher, and that teacher teaches to them, just regurgitates content to them, and they expect the kids to ingest that content and to learn. Now we have all these amazing digital tools that can be used to help children learn more effectively. We have tools that can be used to personalize education for pupils, for specific children. So you can learn the way you learn best. Not just, oh, just sit here and listen to the teacher and try and memorize content. How do you learn best? Maybe it's verbal, maybe it's reading. How you learn best is the way we're going to teach you. Technologies, when it comes to spiritual education, can be transformative as well. I can listen to a sermon from any pastor on the planet. Any pastor on the planet, I can listen to a sermon from. I can go on a Sunday morning, I can get up, and I can go watch a church service in Ghana. I can go watch a church service in Russia, wherever. I can go watch a church service in Oklahoma or New York or Atlanta. I can consume those church services anywhere. I can learn from anybody in the world. And that is at my fingertips. And so I have that ability. I have that ability to connect with other Christians around the world to learn from those Christians.
Here's my friend Amy Coleman discussing how technology has transformed her experience in Bible studies.
I do BSF, which is Bible Study Fellowship. And this particular Bible study that I'm a part of is an international Bible study, and it goes on during a school year. So it begins in the fall and it ends in the late spring. And there are chapters all over the world, and it's broken up into men's chapters and women's chapters. I've been doing this for, I want to say this is my fifth year doing it. And I love it because I honestly feel like this is more of my church than going to church. The way that it's set up is you have a weekly study. It's reading the Bible and it's reading the notes that the creators of this Bible study have written. And it's listening to a lecture about the text that we've written. Then you meet in a small group to discuss all of these things. This year and last year, I've been able to do it online. They have a whole separate online section where I can join a group and all of the members are from all over the world and we meet together once a week on Zoom. And it's wonderful because I feel like I'm gaining relationship with these other believers, but I'm also diving farther into the Word and I get to hear their perspectives. And we go through the weekly questions together and the Lord just speaks to me through this Bible study. And I feel like I have learned so much in the past 5 years from doing this specific Bible study.
Now, while I love my pastor at my church and I enjoy his sermons, which are generally engaging and generally I learn something at each one, his sermons are not the primary influence of my spiritual or biblical education. And I think that's true for a lot of us now. There are podcasts like this one. There are books. There are YouTube videos. There are all sorts of ways for us to access information and education that better meets us exactly where we are at. That means in the ways that we most resonate with and also meeting us where we are in our particular journeys in our spiritual paths. And while a lot of this content may come from certain churches or community service churches, such as Life Church or others, generally speaking, if you look at just the sheer number of churches out there compared to the churches producing the content that is being consumed by others, I think it is not just fair but obvious to say that our community service churches no longer play the role in our individual or communal lives as being the primary influence of spiritual or biblical education. The one exception to this is the education of our children, which since the 1980s has probably only grown in demand and offering, mostly because it follows the absence of spiritual or biblical education in our public school systems. So the community service churches still play a primary role in regards to the children. In regards to the adults, it's just not what it used to be. Which brings us to the next point, which is this concept that a community service church provided a sense of community. Here's Lance Humphreys talking about this issue in regards to the community service church.
We are made in the image of God. We are so relational. And, you know, the reason that a lot of, you know, the truth is, honestly, you can talk about, you know, I like this preacher, I like that worship leader, or whatever. The reason people attend whatever local community they attend for them is 90%. It's where their people are. It's where their friends are.
Lance's insight really reminded me of Luke Whitmire, of how he followed his relationships into a church rather than trying to create a church around his relationships. Now, it's not bad to go spend time worshiping God with people you are most familiar with, but we all understand the consequence of that. You know, Sunday morning has been accurately described as the most segregated hour in America, mostly influenced by geographic but also interpersonal relationships, and how that drives us to the churches we attend. Here's Chris Brewster, who grew up in the Philippines and was very surprised to see what the American church looked like on Sunday mornings.
My initial foray into the church in our country was the same. When I came back from the Philippines, where denomination was obscured and race was obscured and age was obscured in the church families that I was in, I saw racially divided churches, especially socioeconomically divided churches, and did not quite understand what was going on in my country. As a third culture kid or a blue culture kid, I was and still struggle to make sense of the two cultures that I know well. I love my country and I love being an American, but I have a very critical lens that I view my culture with.
Here's Marcus Jackson. He runs a nonprofit on the Northeast side, and we're going to talk a lot more about him in our next episode. Here's his perspective on the issue of race and church.
So I believe that for the church to impact like this bubble concept, like, you know, this church, this community, like all black church, this community, all white church, we have to be realistic and say that people are going to go where they feel naturally comfortable. I don't think we always have to like view everything as a negative or intentionally bad thing. It's deeper than that. So it's like, well, this church in Edmond, it's all white people. I'm like, okay, well, how many black people live over there? Oh, like little bitty amount, and then they go to Life Church. You know what I mean? It's like, I feel like sometimes those things are more basic and cut and dry than they seem to be by the way it's presented. My church I grew up in was a pretty exclusively black church in an exclusively black neighborhood with black pastors. Why would a white guy come over there? And what would they be coming to do? Because if they're coming into church just to add diversity, I don't even know if that's like what the mission of the church or God is.
So I asked Marcus, who was to blame for this segregation of America on Sunday mornings?
The system of America created racial boundaries and communities. And naturally, the churches, the schools, all of those things are going to have predominant races based on that community. It's not a church problem. We can't put that on the church. The church, they open a church. Who live over here? White people. They didn't do anything wrong. They started a church. They planted a church. That's great. They're sharing the gospel. That's great. They're empowering the community.
Marcus actually has some pretty good ideas of how churches can help bridge the divide in our segregated communities. But again, we're going to talk about that next episode. Right now, I think it's important for us to understand how geography and political science created geographical boundaries in our communities. But once again, here comes technology. Here's Corey White again discussing how technology has transformed our concept of community and relationships.
In the past, how we defined community was mostly the people who we were in proximity to. They were our neighbors. They were our friends. They were our family. They were the people that we saw on a daily basis. Then, you know, as technology, maybe when we talk about technology, you might say transportation. We get cars, we get airplanes. Maybe our network grows because we move to different cities. We don't stay in the same community for our entire lives. We branch out. We move from city to city to city. We chase a different job. So our community grows as we start to know people in different cities. Maybe we don't stay in touch, though. We lose touch. Maybe there's one or two we might talk on the phone with in the past. You know, we talk on the phone, maybe wish a happy birthday or, you know, a Merry Christmas to. So we talk maybe a couple of times a year. We stay connected, but not really. And then we get social technologies, and it totally changes our idea of community, because now our network explodes. It explodes because now we can be connected forever to every person we've ever met, to people we just had a casual conversation with on the street, somebody we met at a conference, somebody who just we haven't even met. We just like something about them. We like the way they look. We like the way they write. We like the way they produce content online, whatever. We connected to everybody.
So I had to ask Corey, will technology completely replace physical presence?
When we talk about in-person versus real-world connections, I don't think it's substituting. It's altering. We are altering the more things we do online. And it's not necessarily substituting for it, but it's altering. So if I'm a single guy, which I am, if I'm going to try and meet a significant other, in the past, I might go to a bar. I might go to the gym. I might go somewhere where I might potentially meet somebody. Today, more than likely, I'm going to go on a dating app. It doesn't change the fact that I'm trying to make a connection. It just changes how I make that connection. Today, we used to just talk on the phone. Now we use teleconference, or we use, you know, video conferencing on our phones, so we can have that face-to-face interaction, but be in different areas. So I don't think it substitutes, but I think it alters it.
So to sum up, community service churches still provide important resources for the raising of children in the way of providing entertaining and energetic ways to teach kids about the Bible or other spiritual matters. However, when it comes to adults, the community service church has drastically diminished its influence in our personal lives and being our primary influences in our spiritual and biblical education. Now, it still plays a part in helping develop and foster communities. However, that has been greatly diminished as well. We no longer identify ourselves or our communities as just our work, family, and church lives. There are just too many ways that we maintain and can create new connections for us to relate our communities to just those three buckets. And so this brings us to our final primary influence in our communities and personal lives: the corporate worship service. This concept of corporate worship hasn't changed in the Christian church in the last 40 years, 200 years, and maybe for the entire 2,000 years of the church's existence. After COVID, I think we can all agree that there is no substitute to gathering together with other believers to worship God. So no matter the technology, community service churches still play the primary role in our lives in providing a space for corporate worship. And if we're going to talk about the corporate worship experience, there may be no church that focuses more heavily on that worship experience than Life Church. Here's Stefan Reed, the lead pastor of the Midwest City campus.
We call it the tension between comfort and confrontation. So everything that happens from the parking lot into the auditorium and worship is designed for comfort, meaning we need to help people feel comfortable and help them drop their guard, help them drop the walls that they may have. And who knows what someone's coming in church, what they feel. They could be feeling judged because they're not dressed well enough, or are people looking at me weird, or they may feel guilty because you don't know what I did the night before, or they may be nervous because I haven't been in church in 10 years, or they could be excited, or they could be anxious. There's all these things that people are going to walk into church with. And we don't know, obviously. So we design everything from the street to the seat to create a comfortable experience, because we need them to drop their walls and their guards and their preconceived notions and their fears and their anxieties.
Now, when I met Stefan Reed at the Midwest City campus, I was surprised to find that half of that campus is a huge warehouse. With the 42 and county campuses for Life Church across the country, not only is there a lot of work to be done to coordinate pastors and messages and communications and more, but logistically there are issues. This warehouse was their solution to their unique logistical problems. The warehouse has rows and rows of metal racks with all these cool-looking couches and posters, audio equipment, chairs, tables. There was these little cubbies that I found that apparently has all the Life Kids curriculum and arts and crafts and whatever else they're going to be doing for each of their Sunday services. And as Stefan walked me through their filing and organizational system, it matched what I've seen before in my past working in some major warehouses for Lowe's and Walmart. As kind of a side note here, I met Life Church's oldest employee back there. This was an individual who worked for Metro Church back before Life Church and Metro Church merged in Oklahoma City in the very early days of that organization. And because this individual worked for Metro Church longer than those who worked at Life Church, he was kind of grandfathered in to be the oldest employee. He now runs this warehouse and keeps it incredibly clean and running like clockwork. Here's Stefan Reed talking about some of their logistical issues that they handled there at that warehouse.
As the campuses are growing in a portable location, then obviously they're going to need equipment and material. So what the warehouse will do is we have an entire mini church portable that is housed back there so that we can take this portable material and these resources, put it in a semi, drive it out to whatever location, park the semi, and bring all this material out, set it up in about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, and then have church. And so you'll have a portable Life Kids area. You can set up portable staging and lights and music, soundboard, the video screen, all that stuff. You set up your portable hospitality area, and all this stuff will go up in either a hotel or a school. And so here at the warehouse, we'll draw out exactly what that looks like. And we have enough space where you can set up tape and lines, and we'll walk through and show the campus team exactly how to set everything up, where it goes, what it's supposed to look like, how to set it up, how to tear it down, how to pack it, how to store it, and how to do it all again the next weekend. Super efficient, very fast. They've got it down to an art. It's actually pretty incredible. And then all of that material, essentially, once the campus opens, then all of that is brought back here, sits in the warehouse, hangs out until the next campus opens, and rinse and repeat.
I love that story. It reminded me so much of the old school kind of traveling revivals across our country in the early 1900s. They did a portable church in a truck. Their church were some pillars, a tent, maybe a podium, and some chairs. Life Church is much more advanced than that, but I think the spirit is the same. But there's one more thing that resonated with me as I talked with Stefan. As he talked about the intentionality and hyper-focus of their worship experiences, of bringing everything down to a T, of trying to ensure that you could go into any Life Church and have something of the same experience with the same timing, especially because many of their services when they were first beginning were kind of satellite linked. And so you had to have everything at multiple locations running at the exact same time. And so it hit me, and I understand this is maybe sacrilege depending on what side of the denomination you are, but it really seemed to resonate with the Catholic Mass. As it turns out, at the beginning of our interview, Stefan told me that he grew up Catholic. And so I just had to ask the question. Now that he was a pastor of a Life Church, did he see any similarities between the Life Church worship experience and the way Catholics approach their Mass?
Oh, thought about that. That is an interesting question, how the similarities between the Catholic Church and the Mass versus Life Church. So I would say the biggest commonality is really the structure. So I would say with the Catholic Church and with us, again, really it's all about Jesus. Like it's very focused and very honed in on Jesus and him crucified and what he did on the cross for our sins so that we can have life through him. So the theme, and I know you could say that about a lot of churches, but I think Catholicism really does a great job at over accentuating Jesus's role in our lives. And I think that's a beautiful thing. So and we'll do the same thing. Like we'll come in, and I know the criticism of our church sometimes is, you know, it's big, it's bright, it's shiny. And you have all the toys and Starbucks coffee and, you know, is that even church? Why do you have loud music and why are lights hitting my eyes and all these things that you can say about the church? But one thing you can't say is you can't say we don't preach the gospel, and you can't say that we don't talk about the fact that we're all sinners, every single one of us, and that we all need Jesus and his salvation through him. So we will preach that message and we'll be unashamed about doing it. And so I would say that the similarities. I also say the structure. Now, I realize that a Catholic Mass, the structure is very different, but I say structure as far as maybe almost like procedure, essentially. So the Mass is a very structured, organized thing. And then underneath of what we do, we have a very structured experience. And mainly because you have, let's see, where are we at? 42 locations? Soon to be 45. So we're open three like in the next 3 months, I think. But our experience is very structured. Now, it may not look like that on the surface, but we have to have everything run down to the minute because every church location is all running off the same clock. So it's very structured. Catholicism is also very structured as well.
Now, obviously, you know, a Life Church experience is very different than the Catholic Mass, but their underlying intentionality seems to be the same. Here's Patrick Raglow discussing the ritual of the Catholic Mass.
And even ritual, right? Our liturgy is rich with ritual. Now, is the ritual the end state? No. It's the on-ramp to relationship. But it's also that it's not about us, and it's a deeply powerful prayer service, deeply scriptural, by the way. And so for the uninitiated, it can feel really awkward, but I can go to any Catholic church anywhere on the planet, whatever the language, and I'm in. Anywhere on the planet, because it's the same overall structure, and it's a beautiful thing.
So with the reduced or now absent primary influences in our individual lives and communities, does this mean that the only important influence that these community service churches play are to entertain some kids with a spiritual background and then to provide us a corporate worship service? Here's Phil Brookman, the pastor of Memorial Road Church of Christ, discussing this issue.
Just going to a worship service is kind of like just going to a movie. And it's interesting, and you might laugh, you might cry, but then you go home, and it doesn't really change your week very much. Doesn't really change your life very much. So for people where church is simply a once a week attendance thing, I just get my rear end in that pew so I don't feel guilty. That's not church. That's just showing up for a production.
Whatever church you're at, get invested and get involved, because the church doesn't exist to serve you. Is that we exist to serve others. You go to the church to serve others.
And that brings us to the core of the problem we are dealing with today. When we go into a community service church and we want to get engaged, we ask that community service church, how can we help? And the options we get back don't look like what we had in the 1980s. And they definitely don't look like the options we had in the 1800s. in my experience, and maybe it's just me, when I ask how can I get engaged in the church and serving our community, the options I get are usually about 80 to 85% related to helping out with a worship experience or yet another biblical or spiritual educational program. Let me give you a few examples here. First, from me, I wanted to get involved and give back to my church. And so I signed up to lead a, what I call, the bucket list book club. This is for a bunch of dorks like me who wanted to read all the kind of old, classical, great Christian works. And so we started with Dante's Divine Comedy, moved on to Pilgrim's Progress, and then C.S. Lewis's Pilgrim's Regress. And we are currently going through Paradise Lost. And while I cherish my time with my fellow dorks reading these books, it doesn't really feel like I am serving my community by leading this book club. And I thought it was just me, or maybe I was just thinking about it wrong. But then I had the experience of helping with the Afghan resettlement effort. And that experience not only created stronger bonds with people in the church in a way that I hadn't felt before and was not even able to replicate in my book club, but it also made me feel like I was part of the church in the sense that I was serving the community in the way the church is supposed to be serving its community. Let me share a couple of examples from those I interviewed about this issue of the failed promise that serving in a church fulfills your desire to serve your community. First, here's Amy Coleman. If you remember, she had a bad experience in a small group setting, but her and her husband moved churches and experienced a wonderful invitation to participate in the new small group. Very quickly, her and her husband got involved in the church, with Amy taking on some of the roles in the children's ministry and her husband helping set up for Sunday services.
We love the people at this church. They're all very welcoming, and I like the messages that I hear coming from the pulpit. We wanted to start serving right away so that we felt like we were helping and using our gifts for the body. So that's why I'm continuing to serve in the children's ministry. My husband was serving on Serve Crew, which was like set up and tear down, because this congregation doesn't have a permanent space. So we meet in an event space and set up and tear down every Sunday. So even though we've really kind of gone head first into doing all the church things, we still don't really feel like we're a part of this church.
Maybe another way to describe my feeling and Amy's feeling is volunteering in the church still doesn't give that sense of fulfillment of walking out the mission that Christ gave us. Here's one more story from my friend Alan Carr, which really illustrates the problems of how our community service churches are failing to interact with the communities around them.
Well, let me give you an example of, I was not the head pastor of this church at the moment. But so a group of us from the church, mainly ministers and a couple other people, went and met with the Chamber of Commerce because we were like, we need to be rooted in our community. We had this big desire to say, we need to be rooted in this community. And so what better way to do that than meet with the Chamber of Commerce? Let's see what else is going on. Let's see how we can help. And through that kind of meeting and meeting with the Chamber, one of the things we realized in our local community we needed on the south side of Oklahoma City was, you know, there's a bunch of food trucks. There's a couple needs. One, there's food trucks who are looking for space to be there, especially on weekends, and just be able to operate out of. Number two was it was part of the city that struggled with, there were communities and neighborhoods, but communal experiences for that type of place. So in talking to the Chamber, we kind of said, well, you know what? Let's see. We have a fairly large building we don't use, and we have a lot of parking space. So the original concept, the idea, is a care for our community and a realization that we had something to offer our community, which was we had a parking lot. So the idea was, let's get with some of these local business people and let's offer them our space to be a good neighbor once a month for a food truck event. Now, there's a long story here in between, but the end product of that was the process of kind of coming up with that. The only way the church knew how to do this was it became not something that we just offered, a resource we had to our community. We didn't go ask anybody else how to do this. We didn't say, who else puts on a good event? We said, we have some stipulations, so we need control. So it became a church event. Because the thing we knew how to do was offer religious service. So we created a food truck event for our community. And a lot of the conversation was, well, how do we get people interested in our stuff? Well, maybe we'll open up our church and they can come see our children's ministry. I was like, that's not what they're there for. Like, we just had, it was this clash between a really honest, you know, authentic desire to be a good neighbor and help our community. And the idea of, well, the only thing we know how to do is create a church event. And so when those two things clashed, we created a kind of hybrid event that was a Frankenstein monster, where all it was an event that wore out our church people. We didn't know what it was really for, and it died after a summer. And that's because it wasn't because the church people and leadership didn't really truly want to meet the need of our community. It's we didn't have the expertise, we didn't know how, so we just defaulted to everything we knew that we were doing, and we just churched harder. Well, that wasn't a church harder event. That was a, let's just be a good neighbor and let's turn it over to someone who knows how to do it. And let's just say, we love you, our community. We're glad we're here. We have a resource you can use. So there's issues of control there. There's issues of the church and expertise and not having the tools it needed to do what it wanted to do. But there's just a clash of competing desires there too.
So the question may not be, what can congregations do to help the church get involved in its community? Maybe the question is, what can this model of church do to assist their communities? What made sense in the past doesn't seem to fit well with our current needs in our communities, or at least not the current expectations of our communities of what it means to be a service to it. Now, that's not a knock on the church at all. That is just a statement of the evolving society has created maybe an evolved need. And that need, or maybe those needs, aren't really well served by the model of the church that worked well in the 1800s and even in the 1980s. And maybe that's why Gen Z's not showing up. Maybe they can't see the value. And maybe that's not an issue of messaging. Maybe that's an issue of, what are you actually inviting them to partake into? Because if you're asking them to contribute to something that doesn't seem to fit well or doesn't seem to serve well, they're going to look back and say, what's the point of this? And I think if we're honest, it's very difficult to have an answer to that question. But I think it's very dangerous to not try to understand that question and to not give an honest attempt at answering it. Here's Marcus Jackson talking about his experience and what he sees coming in this next generation of the church.
If you think millennials are a problem, this bunch behind me, the Gen Z, they're going to rip the church apart. I'm telling you, like, if we can't get our stuff together, I'm already dealing with them. I'm already dealing with Gen Z. And I'm telling you, they're not like us. And they're definitely not like those before us. If we're a problem to the church, where they say, oh, the millennials coming in, shaking everything up, you know, you're going to close. I'm telling you. They will shut your joint down. And just with their phone. You understand what I'm saying? They will pull a phone out and your church will shut down. Like, this is a different group. And they're like, we ain't doing nothing that we don't like or that don't make sense. you better start making sense.
I think a common and natural reaction for any institution, and in this case, the community service church, is to work real hard to reinsert itself into the services of the community. However, there are two other major aspects of society that have changed over the years. First, before the 1980s, there was just a lot more available labor in a community service church because our country didn't have as many dual income families. In the 1980s, typically the mothers would stay home, but not always. But the percentage of dual income families has dramatically increased from the 70s till now, which means there's just a lot less labor resource available in community service churches to provide the type of services they used to be able to provide. And the second big one is the specialization that has occurred in our society, where before we would look at our pastors or our church leaders to be kind of a jack of all trades, we both understand and have better access to more specialized care to help deal with the particular issues that can ail individuals or communities. What I mean by specialization are those who can work full-time addressing a specific need, so they can understand all of its nuances and avoid all the pitfalls and other problems that can come when someone who is either not educated or experienced or has very little experience in the particular issue that is affecting a person or a community. One great example of this is counseling. Spiritual counseling used to take a place of any number of behavioral or mental health issues of individuals. And while that was a good thing, I think it's better that we have more specialized care now, depending on what your issues are. Here's Alan Carr talking about this issue.
Like, for as long as religious or pastoral, you know, kind of education and training has been around, you're going to be counseling people. You're going to be walking through them. You're going to be guiding them. You are a spiritual guide. But along with that, there's also this realization of, yeah, I'm not a therapist, though. So some of this is just the natural kind of specialization of an industry. And counseling is a great example of it has become more specialized in a way that it's really healthy that people don't come to the pastor when they need substance abuse counseling, right? I mean, you go to a substance abuse counselor, and even within the profession, it's become specialized. So it's a recognition of what exactly it is. And somewhat a movement away from the church that kind of go, that pastor doesn't have to be everything to everybody either. So there's probably lots of dynamics. I think when it comes to church, I think we struggle sometimes because we almost long for a time, certain generations of us do, for a time when it seemed, at least it felt nostalgically, that the church, if you needed anything, you could go to the church. And on some level, yeah, maybe that was the case on some level. You know, you had something you could go to the church because it was at least a safe space where you could go talk to the preacher about it. But it's also not a good thing that, or it's probably a better thing that we're not relying on this certain group of people to be all things.
Here's Kim Bandy, one of the founders and leaders of the Sparrow Project, talking about how unintentionally some of these problems can occur when a community service church tries to insert themselves into a dynamic they don't fully appreciate and maybe don't have the proper expertise or tools to actually help the need they are attempting to assist with.
Oftentimes, individuals, groups, churches can do is they unknowingly, they don't realize, I think, how much energy there is in relationship and how complicated it is to try to add people in at a, you know, coming through. At worst, our culture, I think, really can do charity tourism, and it's fundamentally detrimental to the dignity of the people that you want to engage.
What Kim is getting to is this concept of toxic charity. There are many books about this now, and a lot of nonprofits really understand and appreciate the problems that come when you just give things or money and you don't do the deeper work that is necessary to address the particular need at hand. Now, to be clear, this does not mean that charity in of itself is bad. It's just by itself, charity doesn't do a lot of good, and it might actually do more harm than good.
And so, obviously, food, clothing, shelter, physical safety is high on the list. So we do need housing that is safe and large enough for families, and in a space where congregant families can live together for a community. People, of course, need employment and transportation and medical care. I think fundamentally that version of support will only be continue to meet needs if we partner it with what every person needs, which is to be known, to be valued, to guide their own life. And so there's tangible needs, and then there is, yes, there's so much need for long-term relational walking. I think organizations need donations to help to hire people. Refugee resettlement work is extremely nuanced. It is not traditional social work. It is not traditional work in international communities. It is a really interesting, I don't want to say interesting, that sounds voyeuristic. It's a really complicated, nuanced blend of cultural pieces and social dynamics and moving towards sustainability with honor. And so organizations need people that, because what we're finding on this group of resettled communities, as I'm watching people who are now like sponsor families, and they're showing up and they're incredible, and I'm hearing them tell me the lessons they learned that are the lessons I learned 12 and 15 years ago. And I'm not saying they should have not learned those lessons. I'm just saying there's a lot of value in providing continuation where people who have walked those paths with the resettled community and can learn less lessons and make less mistakes in the effort of best serving new neighbors is really important. So staffing organizations that work on behalf of refugees, I do think is really important.
Kim didn't know it, but she was talking about me. With our family from Afghanistan, we certainly made some mistakes and some big mistakes with a good heart trying to do the right thing. And as it turns out, if we had just done a little bit more research or talked to someone with a little more wisdom, we could have made some different choices, and maybe, just maybe, we could have helped out that family propel a little faster in their resettlement here in America. Looking back on that now, I do think that maybe it would have been better to have pooled more money together to allow Sparrow Project to hire someone with the proper experience or education and access to the wisdom of the Sparrow Project's collective leadership. But I also want to talk a little more about what Kim was really getting to, which is really the soul of the individual, or maybe you could say the soul of a community service church. And asking some very difficult questions, trying to figure out if this thing you're doing really is for the purpose of being good and sacrificial, or is it for something else?
I would say initially I really was driven by wanting to understand and follow the ways of Jesus. I started with a charity mindset. That was my background. That's what I understood. And so I probably accidentally signed up for more than I meant to. And I thought like I was a terrible, like my grid was charity. And then through engaging the refugee community, was fully discipled by my Christian neighbors, my Muslim neighbors, my agnostic neighbors, about kind of the weakness that I had when I was thinking charity and faith or evangelism or whatever was in my mind that I thought I was supposed to do. And so immediately kind of recognized the anemic state my life was in. And then my neighbors immediately reflected back to me what it looked like to be full of hospitality and grace and love and resilience and community in the face of struggle. And I just was like, oh, well, I have to be more like you. So we've just spent the rest of the years asking our neighbors to teach us to be more like them.
Kim's witness of the power of sacrificial love outside of the church was equal parts beautiful and heartbreaking. I asked her whether today she considered the foundational reason for her efforts in the Sparrow Project to stem from her labeling herself as a Christian.
For me, it's taken a journey. Like my husband would say, it is a fully spiritual space for him. I, many years ago, was wrestling with that and hit the end of being willing to feel fearful about it, whether it was or wasn't, and if I was losing something I was supposed to keep, and just decided I didn't want to participate in fear. And so it was painful and hard. And now I would say, like, I genuinely don't know and I can't tell you. And I feel fine about it. Now I think it's really driven by the question, like, genuinely, what would it look like if we all cared about our neighbor? And there are obviously tenets of that you can put into, like, my faith background, I'm sure, was the driver of that. And I still resonate with so much of that. But I'm personally, and this may be too much for you, but I'm personally in a season where I don't need to, like, notch it anymore.
In my interviews, I also met another ex-pastor, Trevor Cox. He's a professor at the University of Central Oklahoma. For a number of different reasons, he can't bring himself to attend a church anymore. So I asked him whether or not he still labeled himself as a Christian.
So you were asking where I fall. Like, yeah. We've got some friends who really need the Christian label. Like, that's really important to them. And they're some of our closest friends, but that label's really important to me. That label is not important to me. I think Jesus has important things to say. Jesus is kind of, I mean, I've got Christian symbols on my wall. I've got, you know, those kinds of things. I don't need the label. I don't really care. So, like, whatever you want, like, agnostic, Christian, you know, like, I just don't care. So a lot of people need that label, and there's some tension there. My kids know who Jesus is. We pray every night. And kind of what we've tried to do is connect some of those things. You know, I'm raising three white males. And so we have those conversations all the time, but we kind of connect them back to, well, Jesus wants to do this and help us understand. And we're pretty with our older ones. Like if they ask it, well, why don't we go to church? Well, you know how we've talked about the way systems are, and we just think a lot of systems have a problem with that, and we just won't do it. And it doesn't mean, you know, that anybody's bad for doing those things. It's just kind of the choices that we've made.
Without being engaged in the church, I asked Trevor where he found his community.
People ask me all the time, well, you got to have church to have community. Like, I've got great community. We've got good friends. We have people in our lives that we deal with the big stuff and the hard stuff and all that kind of things. I've got that. Honestly, for me, one of the things that has been really helpful is things like podcasts and books and other to know I'm not crazy. There's a whole group of people who think and do and believe the exact same things I do, who call themselves Christians and who are part of this faith tradition.
And that brings us to the problem of today. As I mentioned in the opening quote for this docuseries, there are many people with a heart and desire to help our communities and to serve in the way that Jesus showed us. but they can't find that in a community service church. And it's bigger than just where they choose to spend their time. The inability of the community service church to insert itself in the place of the community that it used to serve creates this identity crisis. And it's the question that I started asking myself as I began my journey trying to figure out what this church thing really was. As both Kim and Trevor describe, I was having a hard time defining myself as a member of a church, as a member of the Big C Church, and even sometimes defining myself as a Christian, because those labels didn't seem to match the reality of the world I saw and the truth of how I felt about my spiritual journey. And like many others that I talked to in these interviews, it left me wondering what's next for the church.
I think that's the frustration for me, is that I don't know what the other thing is. And I read an article one time that kind of talked about leaving Egypt and going into the wilderness, and they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. That's kind of what it feels like. And I think maybe that there's some wisdom to that, of we don't necessarily have to jump to the next thing, because if you jump too quickly to the next thing comes exactly like what the old one was. So, you know, we have friends that are in the church planning world and they're like, we want to do something different. And when you really start asking, okay, well, what's going to be different? Like, are you doing this? Are you doing, well, yeah, we'll probably eventually do that. It's like, okay, well, eventually the same old stuff is going to happen. And eventually, because it's so, the problematic things are so embedded in the DNA, even when you start a church, people come in with all of those assumptions and all of those ways of seeing Christianity. And so those eventually kind of come out and become institutionalized again. So I don't know what the new thing is. Whatever the new thing is really has to be serious about, let's look deeply at our history and deeply at how we have gotten to this point and really be honest and continually looking at how we're not going to replicate that.
Here's Lance Humphrey's thoughts.
As pioneering as Bridgeway was, and there are plenty of others, it's still, you know, man, I don't care what you say about, you know, well, we're different, we're this, we're that, you know. If you got a budget and staff and a building and you gather on Sunday mornings or whenever, and you know, you got a missions program and you know, you're that thing that we've been doing in this country for, you know, in that way for, you know, probably a better part of 100 years. And it doesn't work very well in terms of seeing the kind of transformation that Jesus modeled and taught and that we were shown we could expect in the book of Acts.
To be clear here, Lance attends a community service church. So do I. Lance is not saying there's no value in a community service church. The words he just used was an accurate description that the community service church does not appear to be capable of transforming our society to fix the ailments in our communities. That is the central question of this entire docuseries. Every person I've discussed this with, including those I've interviewed, understand this current failure of the community service church.
I don't think it's worth a lot of time and energy throwing rocks at the old system. There was a nutty guy named Daniel Quinn. I mean, that's tongue in cheek. I've never met him. I don't know him. I don't think he's a follower of Jesus. He's, you know, advocating for something, but I like to read people who think radically about stuff. But he wrote a book called Beyond Civilization. And in it, he says, you know, if you want to work toward the new thing, you don't spend any time, you know, trying to throw rocks at the old thing and trying to change it. You just start doing the new thing. And in that sense, it's already happened, right? So, you know, You know, you are the change. So I think that the way forward is, you know, we don't have to shut anything down. We don't have to belittle anyone for their life choices, career choices, how they, you know, if people want to continue to support those organizations, whatever, all that's great.
Here's Chris Brewster, who has done some amazing transformational work, not just in church, but also in education and the way that he is serving the community on the south side of Oklahoma City in his charter school system.
So I think maybe my advantage has been that I've thought about this in the context of school reform, sort of in advance of when I got into the ministry reform. And there are sort of three options available to those of us in education who are disgusted with what we're doing. You can work to reform it from inside. So in the church context, you can work to reform existing structures. And we know that that is a really dense, difficult work to ever change a church from the inside, but God can do that as well. You can blow the whole thing up, deconstruct it. You can nuke the entire system and then grow it from the ground up. Or you can build a parallel system and that competes, but I mean in a positive way, in the same way that life forms would compete for strength, and you can build a positive competition. These words don't fit the context, but a parallel system where you can see what thrives, and then a very natural sort of evolution occurs as a result of it.
So if you've been with me this far, I hope that you'll join me to take the next step, which involves us dropping the identity of being a child of the community service church and instead reclaiming our identity in the church as not something static, not just one particular place or one particular form, but rather redefining the church as we were originally described in the Bible. We weren't called Christians. We were called followers of the way.
I hide my face from the one who made it, as if you do not see the man that I've become. I let my darkness win.
If you would like any more information about the people you've heard in this episode, you can check out the notes section wherever you are listening to this podcast. You can also go to our website, www.thefourthchurch.com. Make sure you spell out the word fourth. If you will give me your email address, I can send you some resources about the Fourth Church concepts that we describe in this docuseries. This was narrated by me, Caleb McCoy. I did some editing, but I also got some help from Rose Records. The opening song is from Sean C. Johnson. You can hear his music on any streaming service. Make sure it's Sean C. Johnson. And these end credits are by The Foolish Things. From their 2021 record, Outside Looking In, produced by Shady Neighbor Records. You can find their music wherever you find streaming, and you can also go to their website to buy CDs or to book them. Drag me by.